Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. On December 31st, the Bush tax cuts, which gave affluent Americans an especially sweet break, are set to expire unless Congress votes to extend them. Republicans say higher taxes now will kill growth when we need it most. Many Democrats say it's high time for the well-off to do their bit for the unemployed and the deficit. This hour, On Point, the future of American taxes and who should pay what now. You can join the conversation. Where do you see American taxes headed? Is it high time for the better off to pay more or not? Time to extend cuts or let them expire? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Washington is Douglas Holtz Aiken. He directed the Congressional Budget Office from 2003 to 2005, served in top roles at the Council of Economic Advisers under both Presidents Bush, was chief economic advisor to 08 candidate John McCain. He's president of the Center-Right American Action Forum. Douglas Holtz Aiken, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you, Tom. Happy to be here.
And joining us from Washington is Dean Baker, economist and co-director of the Progressive Center for Economic and Policy Research, author of False Profits, Recovering from the Bubble Economy. Dean Baker, welcome back to you as well.
Thanks for having me on.
Dean, would you be good enough just to remind us of the cuts that went through in 01 and 03? Americans at lots of levels got cuts, especially nice for those with more money perhaps, but just describe what's on the table here as we approach December 31st this year.
Well, essentially, President Bush had put in a 15% across-the-board cut in income taxes. In addition, there was also a change in the treatment of capital gains and dividends. They were taxed at 15% for high-end earners instead of previously 20% for capital gains. And dividends had previously been taxed as normal income, so whatever bracket you're in, you paid that tax on dividends. Now, what President Obama has proposed, these taxes are scheduled to expire at the end of the year, as you had indicated. What President Obama has proposed is to keep the tax break in place for the vast majority of people, people earning less than $250,000 a year. That's well over 95% of the public. But we allow the taxes to expire, the lower tax rates to expire for higher income earners, essentially going back to the tax rates of the Clinton years. So that costs us somewhere in the order of $60 billion a year, or I should say it would get us $60 billion a year in additional revenue, reducing the deficit by that amount. So that's where most of the battle is over. Now, you do have some people. Alan Greenspan, for example, is out there advocating let the whole tax cut expire, but I don't think that's likely a likely proposition politically at this point.
So for the upper income, let's say for the 200, 250-plus, Douglas Holtz Aiken, what have their rates been under the Bush regime here, and what would they be if they revert to the status before those cuts?
Well, the top marginal income tax rate has been 35%. With the sunset of the 2001 and 2003 acts, those marginal rates would go to 39.6. There would also be some essentially hidden phase outs, which would raise the effective marginal tax rates on those individuals to 42%. So there's a substantial rise, a 20% rise in their marginal tax rate.
So I know the two of you come down in different places on what ought to happen here. Douglas Holtz Aiken, let me come first to you. Here we are. We've got big deficits. We've got a lot of unemployment. We've got fiscal problems all over and economic problems all over. Is it time to go the Obama way and let the affluent, kick back up to 39-40% in their tax rate? Is there an argument to hold off on that?
Well, I think the reason this is such a difficult issue is that it affects so many dimensions. It will affect economic growth. It certainly has budgetary implications. There's the long and vaunted battle over who won, who lost with the tax cuts, and your introduction summarized the conventional wisdom, which is a sweet deal for the rich. And then there's the real recognition that you might not want to embrace this tax code entirely because most people think the tax code is pretty broken and needs to be reformed. So in those circumstances, it's not shocking that I think people come down in different places. For me, I don't think there's any question that Alan Greenspan's wrong. It would be a tremendous economic error to allow all of the tax cuts to sunset at the end of this year. We have an economy that's growing very slowly. The kind of impact that would have would be to knock us probably to flat growth or even negative. I'm not one who's forecasting a double dip, but if you wanted one, that'd be a good way to go. So
but
that's
Greenspan's out, and nobody's really proposing that. It's this upper end higher rates coming back. What about that, Dean?
Right. The debate is over who gets an extension and for how long. Mm-hmm. And I think the right way to think about this is that we have an economy that has gone through a terrible recession. We are no longer in the position where we should be thinking about things from the point of one-time aid to the economy to sort of stop the fall, counter-cyclical, quote, stimulus. We have a growth problem. We have millions of people out of work. We have millions of people who have abandoned the labor force because they're so discouraged. Every policy should be focused on raising economic growth. And in this environment, households are too strapped to carry the load. They have big indebtedness. Their homes are down in value. Their pensions have been hit. Governments are equally in bad shape, and I can go on about the outlook for the federal government. That means you should focus on the business community's ability to spend and willingness to spend and our ability to export. In these circumstances, the extension of the top two rates and the extension of the current treatment of dividends capital gains are important business tax policy from a couple of perspectives. Number one, extending them gives them some certainty about what will happen, and there's been a lot of discussion, as I'm sure you're well aware, about how the uncertainty over the policy environment is killing their willingness to hire people.
Chamber of Commerce is beating that drum, yeah.
Absolutely. Business Roundtable, Jeff Immelt, one of their supporters at GE, this is now widely recognized. Second big issue is that a lot of business income, $1 trillion, is taxed on individual income tax reform, in tax forms, because of, quote, pass-through entities, partnerships, subchapter S corporations.
Smaller business in general.
Mm-hmm. This is a business tax issue. And about half of that would be affected by the top marginal rates. About 20 to 40 million jobs would be affected by it. This is the wrong way to go from the perspective of good business tax policy at a time when we need more rapid growth. So I come down on, you know, you give multiple objectives. The top one has to be getting people back to work, has to be growing faster, and we should extend the pro-growth portions of these tax cuts.
Dean Baker, how do you see it? There's the argument that says, you know, if you raise taxes on those with more, you're going to get less growth. That hurts everybody. So extend the Bush tax cuts. Extend the breaks. What do you say, Dean?
Well, I don't think I'm any older than Doug here. You know, we've had this argument again and again and again. Reagan said we're going to cut taxes, we're going to have all this growth. Look at the 80s. We had very weak growth, and in fact, investment fell through the floor, the weakest investment of the post-war period. President Clinton raised taxes. We had all these people running around, that's going to kill the economy. Well, no, actually, the economy did very well in the Clinton years. Lots of problems. I was up there yelling about the dot-com bubble. I know Doug's going to say that. That wasn't great, but the fact was the economy did quite well in the Clinton years, and we had a lot of investment. Then we had President Bush come in and said, oh, we're going to cut taxes, and we're going to see the economy really grow. Well, no, the economy was actually very weak, and we got a huge housing bubble, and it crashed the economy. So you really don't have much of a story here. We've tried this experiment, and I know the businesses are great for whining. They always complain. They always want more. Regulations killing them. This argument about hiring, you know, their businesses are reluctant to hire. We could just laugh this one out of town, because there's a very simple story. You know, as an economist, we should be looking for evidence. If they're reluctant to hire because they're worried about the taxes and the regulation and everything, simple story here. We should be seeing a big increase in hours per worker. In other words, you have all these businesses that were saying, well, we'd really like to hire people, but we're worried about the future. So, you know, we'll just have everyone work more hours. Well, we have the data. That's not happening. Hours actually fell in June. The uptick in hours has been very mild in this recovery so far. The evidence simply doesn't bear this out. We know the businesses want to pay less. I want more money, too. But this isn't a serious story.
Is there an advantage to economic growth to raise these taxes? How does it? I mean, everybody at this point, you know, wants to see the economy doing better. How does a tax, effectively a tax hike, work in that realm?
Well, I have to say, I mean, we have to distinguish between the short-run and long-run situation. Mm-hmm. Realistically, this economy needs massive amounts of demand. I know we have people running around about the deficit, but if I could snap my fingers, I would double the deficit tomorrow, because we have to create demand. That's why 15 million people don't have jobs. It's because there's not enough demand in the economy. We lost $1.2 trillion in annual demand when the housing bubble collapsed. that destroyed residential investment, residential construction, non-residential construction, and people lost somewhere in the order of $6 trillion of wealth in their homes, they stopped consuming. The only way to replace that, at least in the short term, is with the government. So we need more demand, and in that sense, anything that creates demand will foster growth.
Now, how does ending tax cuts, then, in your view, how does that raise demand?
Well, as I say, in the short term, you know, I would just as soon, you know, if you gave me the choice, how do I structure this? I'd want to see more spending, lower taxes for 2011, 2012, probably 2013, even 2014. I wouldn't push them towards the wealthy. I'd rather see them towards people who would spend a larger share of it. But I don't get to design the policies. So somewhere down the road, we will need tax money. And the question is, are we going to tax ordinary workers or are we going to tax higher income people? Given the choice, that's a real easy one for me.
So you're saying higher taxes on the affluent and then turn around and push that money through the government into the economy.
That's right.
We may see some evidence of that today, depending on when you're listening to this show. As soon as Senator Byrd's successor, Cart Goodwin, comes in, they're promising to pass an extension of unemployment benefits. There's been debate about exactly where that money ought to come from. Douglas Holtz Aiken, there's the argument that says, look, we need demand. Let's tax and then spend it and get this thing pumped up before we turn around and go the other way.
I think that's completely mistaken. The evidence we know from our last attempts at this is that this is not very successful. We've had a whole series of exactly the kinds of things Dean is suggesting. President Bush sent checks in 2008. We had an enormous stimulus and bill in 2009. We had cash for clunkers. We had special home buyer tax credits. None of those efforts have generated sustained, robust growth that leads to people getting new jobs. There's all this discussion of sort of multipliers and bang for the bucks, but the reality is when you look at the numbers as I have, and I can go through them with you, there's no evidence that that works. So let's get off this page. We've done it for 2 years. Let's get the economy rolling and help the people who need help.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the future of American taxes, starting with whether or not to extend the Bush tax cuts running out at the end of this year. Douglas Holtz Aiken is with us. He was top advisor to John McCain in his campaign for the presidency in 2008, former director of the Congressional Budget Office, joins us from Washington, D.C. Dean Baker is here, co-founder, director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. He thinks it's time to let go of those Bush tax cuts for upper-income Americans anyway. That's what the Obama administration is looking at. President Obama and many others in Washington looking at unemployment benefits, which have not been extended for 2.1 million or so Americans recently, may have been today, depending when you're listening to this, but drawing a line between those out-of-work Americans and their needs on the one hand, and then tax cuts and tax breaks on the other. Here he was yesterday with three unemployed Americans at his side in the White House Rose Garden talking about the need to extend those unemployment benefits.
After years of championing policies that turned a record surplus into a massive deficit, the same people who didn't have any problem spending hundreds of billions of dollars on tax breaks for the wealthiest Americans are now saying we shouldn't offer relief to middle-class Americans like Jim or Leslie or Denise who really need help.
Dean Baker, is that a fair formulation, that it's tax cuts versus unemployment benefits?
Well, it's not exactly fair, but I don't think it's too far from the mark. I mean, realistically, you know, people are unemployed today. They're not unemployed because they did anything wrong. I mean, these people had been working. They have the skills. You know, people talk about not having the skills and everything. Well, the economy doesn't change that much that quickly. Point was that we messed up in terms of we, meaning people like Doug and I, economists who were running the economy. I'll mention our friend Alan Greenspan here. We let a housing bubble grow. It collapsed, and now these people are out of work. It's not because they did something wrong. It's because, you know, the people, including a lot of people, got the tax cuts, did things wrong.
Douglas Holtz Aiken, you know, you've had Senator John Kyle, Republican, Arizona, saying essentially that it's okay to let the deficit grow to keep the tax cuts in place, but not to pay for unemployment benefits. Is that fair, Douglas?
I think it's very important to recognize that the deficit going forward is a spending problem. And quite frankly, Republicans don't have a great track record on this. During the Bush years, they spent money hand over fist. But neither party has the luxury to be expanding spending and expanding the deficit as a result. If you look forward 10 years under the Obama administration's own budget, the one that includes sunsetting the tax cuts for so-called rich, we're running trillion-dollar deficit, $1.2 trillion in 2020. So tax cuts aren't – sunsetting the tax cuts aren't solving the deficit problem, and we're spending $1.2 trillion more than we typically would in the United States. So we have a spending problem. I believe the correct debate is over learning to pay for your spending initiatives. This is not should not be a debate about unemployment insurance. It should be about learning how to pay for $33 billion, less than 1 cent out of every dollar that the federal government spends. If you can't pay for that, how are we going to reclaim our future and get the fiscal situation under control? That's the issue for the day.
Dean Baker, I mean, the argument that I'm hearing from Democrats who support rolling back these tax cuts is that unemployment benefits, and they're drawing a line between the two, but let, you know, as you say, let the stimulus, let the unemployment benefits roll. That's going to be real spending. That's going to mean economic growth. So, but Douglas Holtz Aiken says, you know, you get into that, you're gonna hurt economic growth, not bolster it.
Well, in the short term, I don't think there's any argument here. If we get more spending, if we get more demand in the economy, that's going to lead to more economic growth right now. I don't know any business that when someone comes to them, you know, with $100,000, go, wait a second, that came through the government. We don't deal with that. You know, maybe there's a business like that. I think it'll be out of business pretty quickly. We need more spending in the economy, and anything the government could do to have more spending in the economy, and that means larger deficits. I understand that. That's arithmetic. But you know, deficits are supposed to create a problem by raising interest rates. And anyone who's looked at the markets lately knows that interest rates are about as low as they're ever going to be. So it's just, you know, the story that somehow deficits are a problem today or they're going to be a problem in 2011, 2012, that's a pretty hard story to tell. Now, down the road, you know, Doug's talking about these deficits, which I should point out are not all that large. I mean, we say $1.2 trillion, but the way economists ordinarily talk about, we talk about relative to GDP. It's around 5%, a bit more than 5% GDP. It's not much different than the deficits we had in the early 90s, which were larger than you want.
But they're projected to grow and grow.
Let me get back to that. You know, Doug's saying it's a spending problem. Well, part of it's spending, certainly. Part of it is revenue, because we will need more revenue. But the other part of the story is that most of the spending here is health care. And, you know, for whatever reason, you have all these people running around Washington are yelling about deficits, deficits, deficits. And they go, all right, well, let's fix the health care system. And they go, that's hard to do. Well, yes, it's hard to do, but that's what we have to do, because really the whole story is our health care costs, our per-person health care costs are more than twice what they are in countries like Canada or Germany or England, pick your country, and they're projected to grow much more rapidly. And if that happens, that's going to devastate the economy. We had GM go out of business, Chrysler, a big story that was health care costs. It also, because half our health care costs are paid through public sector programs like Medicare and Medicaid, the new
President Obama. I don't want to lose the tax thread here, but Douglas Holtz Aiken, on the deficit front itself.
This is really important. So the United States is on an unsustainable track. In 10 years, debt relative to GDP will be 90% or higher, which is the line where most countries get into the inability to borrow in international markets. In 2015, under the administration's budget, the United States will pass the line which Moody's uses for downgrade of sovereign borrowers. We are endangering our very prosperity by going down this track, and it is not to be somehow dismissed as people just running around talking about the deficit. This is the fundamental challenge that we hand to the next generation economy that is as good as the one we inherited and a debt burden that is manageable.
But a huge part of that, of addressing that, is getting the economy up off the ground. Democrats have argued unemployment benefits get spent.
So I have two responses. Yeah. Number one, the way they make that argument is to say, look at these models. For example, Mark Zandi at economy.com has become the poster child of saying, bang for the buck on these.
Mm-hmm. Biggest bang for the model, buck, because people have to spend it. They need the money.
Get out of the model what you put in. And in those models, assume that those policies will get a bigger bang for the buck. If you actually go to the evidence and look at responses to taxes and to spending, even Christina Romer, who's the current chairwoman of the Council of Economic Advisors, found that taxes multipliers are 3-to-1, much higher than the 1.2 or so that are presumed to be the truth in these models. Second piece of evidence. Look at 2009. The administration claimed that the economy was falling like a rock, and it was falling at a 6.4% rate at the end of 2008, and they put in the stimulus package. What we saw, the difference between falling at 6.4% rate and the actual outcome was about $286 billion of GDP. Well, we spent $280 billion of GDP to get it. So basically, for every dollar of spending we put out, we got a dollar of spending. There's no big multipliers. There's no magic. There's no reemployment going on. This approach works on a blackboard, but has failed in the U.S. economy. It is time to change course.
I want to look at what the affluent, what the wealthy themselves are spending here, what that might mean for stimulus. If we may, for a moment, I've got Motoko Rich with us from the New York Times. She had a story in a couple of days ago saying the wealthy are reducing their buying, and that's hurting the recovery. Motoko Rich, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So we're looking here at the issue of whether or not the affluent, the most affluent, ought to be taxed at a higher rate. What's going on with the spending of America's affluent in recent months?
Well, in recent months, it appears that there's been a bit of a slowdown, and that's probably true of most spenders generally. I mean, all the sort of indicators that look at consumer spending and consumer confidence, which are not just measuring one income bracket, are showing kind of a slowdown, mm-hmm. if not a full stop in some cases. What was interesting about the affluent is it appears, kind of looking back toward the middle of last year, was that group, and it depends on how you define it, but for the data that we looked at, we were looking at the top 5% of income earners. That means households earning $210,000 or more.
Okay.
They sort of came back more strongly and started spending with confidence last year. I mean, they sort of totally ground to a halt late 2008 with the financial collapse. And anyone that you talk to that sort of dealt generally with the affluent real estate brokers or Tiffany's or Saks would say that, you know, everything fell off a cliff late 2008 and the first part of 2009.
But it came back in 2009, and this is
yes.
a big deal. I mean, you quote Mark Zandi, Douglas Holtz Aiken was just mentioning him, saying that high-income households actually drove the economy out of recession into recovery
yes,
last year.
Yes, absolutely. That's his theory, that looking at some of the data that he collected from and analyzed from the Federal Reserve, he was looking at something called the savings rate, which is basically the percentage of after-tax incomes that's not spent. And so that's sort of an indicator of spending. And the top 5% of income earners, their savings rate went negative starting in the middle of 2009.
So they were ready to spend even though others weren't.
Exactly. And that coincided, by the way, with a stock market rally that started in the middle of March last year. So a lot of he sort of attributes that to the kind of confidence factor and that their willingness to spend over and above what they earned in sort of salary and dividends to because they were feeling confident about
right.
a stock market rally.
I should say they were ready and able to spend. They had the access to the scratch. Many did not. So what's happened in recent months, Motoko?
Well, what appears to have happened is that there's been a slowdown, and that again coincides with the volatility that we've seen in the stock market as we've had lots of concerns about European instability and also the slowdown that we've seen here. People are always watching the indicators. The markets are very sensitive and nervous, and the affluent tend to be more influenced by the stock market because they're more invested in it, but also because they see it as a kind of a barometer of economic sentiment.
So they've pulled in on their spending, and now we're talking about what would it feel like to them, a tax hike after these recent years of the Bush tax cut? I mean, are people drawing a line between these things? Does this take gas out of the economic engine? Did you ask, Motoko?
Well, what's interesting is that my inbox is certainly filled with a lot of people who are theorizing that was the case. But when I talked to people, really what they were talking about was, I think people in the short term were more talking about the confidence that they were feeling from watching what was going on around them. So when I was walking around some of the high-end malls that we have here in the New York area, when I talked to people, they were talking about, you know, I look around, I'm fine, I haven't lost a job, my husband hasn't lost a job, my wife hasn't lost
mm-hmm.
a job. You know, maybe if they have college-age kids or graduates who are having a hard time finding a job, or they hear about the neighbor or the person that they know or the relative, that makes them nervous. They're also looking at the stock market. Most people didn't actually mention the impending tax hikes because we don't, you know, that's still a matter of fierce debate as we're hearing on
right.
the show. So I think in sort of the short-term decision about, I'm going to buy that or I'm not, I'm going to upgrade to the new model of Mercedes this year or I'm going to wait a few months, I think that the more short-term decisions were being based on kind of immediate indicators that they're seeing around them.
Motoko Rich with the New York Times. Thank you very much for joining us, Motoko.
Thank you.
Dean Baker, what do you make of that? Mark Zandi is saying, look, the affluent drove the recovery last year. Now they're not. If taxes go up, could that be a problem, whether you like it or not, Dean?
Well, a couple things to keep in mind here. You know, depending on the day of the week, we're either giving tax cuts to the wealthy because they're going to spend them,
yeah.
or alternatively, they're going to invest them. Those are contradictory. You do one or the other. You either save
right,
or you
right.
invest. You can't do both with the same dollar. I mean,
mm-hmm.
save or consume. And you know, so it's sort of interesting here that supposedly we need to give the money to the wealthy because now they're going to consume that. Well, we generally think that lower income people are going to consume that, although Doug seems to feel otherwise. But in terms of, you know, this, what's going on with their spending, important to keep in mind a couple things. One is there was a huge rise in the stock market, at least in percentage terms, from its lows in March of 2009 to the end of the year. It was on the order of 40%. There was a huge amount of capital gains. That doesn't count in income. Now, it would be very surprising if the wealthy hadn't spent some of that. Now, whether you're going to see a continued run-up in the stock market, maybe we'll get some decent growth, but we aren't going to see it go up 40% in 9 months. So we're not going to see that. The other point to keep in mind is people have lost an enormous amount of housing wealth. That's affected the wealthy also. So I'd be really surprised if you didn't see some hit to their spending, given the fact that, you know, if we take this top, I think it was 5% that she was focused on,
right.
Top 5%, that, you know, they've probably lost on the order of $1 to $2 trillion in housing wealth. It'd really be surprising if that didn't have some impact on their spending.
Let's hear from our listeners. Morgan in Cabot, Vermont. Morgan, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to point out three trends that have been happening since about the 50s in this country, and one of them, three things that have been trending down steadily, one of them is taxes on the wealthy, and the other is wages. And then the third is the general economic health of the country. Back in the 50s, as Paul Krugman pointed out in his book, The Conscience of a Liberal, the rich were paying something like 90% tax rate. Now they're down in the 30s somewhere. You know, I think there's plenty of cash in this country. It's just stuck in it's out of the reach of common consumers, middle class consumers, and I think we really need to get back to get out of this regressive tax structure that we're in. I'd like to hear the conservative you have on your show address that 90% tax rate in the 50s, where everybody they were still rich, but that was when the country was at its strongest.
Morgan, we've got it, and we'll look at it right here. Douglas, let me just read also a web comment kind of along that line, and you can respond to both. This is from Bob, who says, W. Bush cut taxes, saying it would create 200 to 300 jobs a month. 1 month after leaving office, he had lost almost 8 million jobs. The economy totally failed. There was zero job growth between 2000 and 2010. What did the tax cuts do? What did they accomplish? Put that together with Morgan's observation. What do you say, Douglas Holtzakin?
So I'd like to string that together with the observations from earlier. Number one, let's be clear about the policy that's on the table. It's not about tax cuts for the rich. We're talking about whose taxes will go up. These are not imaginary. These are increases in taxes, and the question is, for whom and for how long?
Well, there were cuts, and now it's whose cuts will be taken away. So, okay, but it's the affluent they're talking about.
This is tax increases. That's all this is.
Yep.
We have tax rates now, and they're going up. And that's an arithmetic fact. The second thing is, I think the report about the high-income people makes the point. For both high- and low-income people, our households are in terrible shape. And repeated one-time stimulus, whether it's a tax cut for a rich person or an unemployment check for a poor person, will not generate sustained economic growth. It has not, and it will not. And we're starting to see it fall off again. That's why, as a matter of process of elimination, not because I like it, you've got to focus on the business community to make this economy grow, because that's the only way we're going to get jobs. And that's why this issue focuses around the business impacts of these tax cuts. That's not a matter of choice. It's a matter of process of elimination. And the third piece is that Dean is right. In many cases, what will happen is not raising taxes will allow people to rebuild their balance sheets. They will be able to fix their credit card problems. They'll be able to fix their mortgage problems. That's a good thing for the consumer over the longer term, and they will be able to stand in line and pick up the ball at the right time. If we don't do that, they'll never be able to pick up the ball.
What about Morgan's observation? Taxes have fallen, wages have fallen, economic health has fallen.
So wages have not fallen. Real wages rise in the United States and have continued to rise. So
that is stalled out for considerable periods over the time.
Compensation paid to workers has risen dramatically, and here Dean's right. Unfortunately, in the past decade, most of that compensation rise has been eaten up by higher health care costs, and so we've seen cash wages not grow. They've stagnated over the years since 2000. So, I mean, that's a serious problem and one that we should have taken care of in the past year but did not. In terms of the difference between the 50s and now, I think the real big difference is the U.S. is no longer a monopoly astride the globe. It was a great luxury to be the only large industrial country standing after World War II, but times have changed. We face enormous competition, and we cannot do the things we did then and expect to be successful now.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the future of American taxes, starting with whether or not to extend the Bush tax cuts running out at the end of this year. We're joined by Douglas Holtz Aiken. He was former director of the Congressional Budget Office, was chief economist to John McCain's presidential campaign in 08. He's now at the American Action Forum. Dean Baker is with us from the Center for Economic and Policy Research, author of False Prophets most recently. They're arguing opposite sides of this case. We've got lots of comments online, on Facebook, you name it. Here's JP says, if we don't want to kill jobs, extend the Bush tax breaks for another 4 years. If jobs are not the most important, let them expire and pay the price. On the other hand, here's Chris, who says, just love that Republicans can't pass extended unemployment benefits because they aren't paid for, but they're fighting to keep the Bush tax cuts, which aren't paid for. Let's go to Maureen in Somerset, Kentucky. Maureen, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you, Tom. Mm-hmm. On NPR News this morning, it was mentioned, there was a story on 17.5 million families in this country not having enough food to eat, not having enough money for food. And I figure we can probably double that number, considering how statistics are now figured since Reaganomics. And also, I may not have the exact facts on this, but GE, as an example of a big corporation, I understand made billions of dollars in profits last year and paid nothing in taxes. And here we are worried about the rich who are trying to buy their next $5,000 wristwatch when children are going to bed hungry every night in this country. I do not understand how we can possibly be talking about giving the rich a break when this is happening in this country. And to say that wages have moved up $7.25 an hour, that's good in this country? I don't think so.
Yeah. Maureen, we've got it. Douglas Holtz Aiken, how do you respond?
So there's no one who's arguing that we want to have a bonus for the rich so they can buy wristwatches. The issue is, how will we get those 17 million Americans to eat adequate amounts, have jobs that will allow them to take care of their families, and move this country forward? And the issue on the table is, how can we grow faster? We have tried a variety of approaches which have left us, even after the economy has ostensibly recovered. We began growing in the third quarter of last year. Job growth returned earlier this year. But we're crawling along at 1.5%, maybe 2%. It's not enough to bring unemployment down. It's not enough to bring millions of people back into the labor force. It's not enough to provide for the needs of American families and our obligations to the future. So the debate is about how best to go forward in those circumstances. I believe the best way to do that is to take the piece of the economy that is positioned to be strong, which is the business and the export communities, and put policies to support their efforts, because that's the route for all Americans to be better off. And that's the only objective, and I think it's important to keep our eye on that ball. There are many parts of tax policy. Some pieces of it are there for fairness issues. Some are there to support social objectives. Some are there to support economic growth. The Bush tax cuts were a mixture of all of them. They didn't have a particular feel to them at all. In these circumstances, I think a priority has to be placed on the growth components and making sure that small businesses, which have contributed over 80% of the hiring thus far, are not hit with a tax increase that stops the one piece of bright news we see in the employment picture.
And what about Dean Baker's observation that, look, hours worked would be going up dramatically if there was really this pent-up demand to hire and people just are too uncertain to act on it, Doug?
Hiring depends on the climate. So the prospect of higher taxes takes a lot of appetite out of hiring. Second is, we've seen great productivity growth. So there is evidence, despite a one-month and only one-month drop in hours recently, there's a lot of sustained evidence throughout the recession that employers are working their employees a lot harder. We're getting a lot more out of them.
Dean Baker, what do you say to Maureen's concern about millions of people without enough to eat? On the other hand, you hear, again, Douglas's argument that, you effectively raise these taxes, you take away from growth that ultimately should provide jobs and food.
Well, she is right to be outraged. I mean, this is entirely preventable disaster. I mean, people talk about this like this is a natural disaster like Katrina. No, this was man-made. It was ineptitude. We never should have been in this situation. And, I had a piece about this morning. I was joking how people in Washington are remarkably forgiving of each other. So somehow we're not supposed to say Alan Greenspan made a mistake that, just pat him on the back. That's okay. No, we should be outraged about this. This is incredible ineptitude.
You're talking about the whole economic crash.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. I mean, this was totally 100% of percent avoidable. It was foreseeable. I and others were talking about this back in 04, 05, 06. When you get an $8 trillion housing bubble, bubbles burst. They are not nice when they burst. This was all foreseeable. And the fact that the people in charge, Greenspan and Bernanke, just turned the other way, and I'll blame people in the Bush administration, I'll blame plenty of Democrats too, This was preventable, and unfortunately, it's not the people who made the mistakes that are suffering. It's, you know, the tens of millions who are without jobs, hungry.
What about growth now? Where's it going to come from?
Well, again, this is a demand-side story. This is where, you know, again, Doug and I can argue about the taxes, but what you're talking about in terms of the tax issue is, at best, a very, very marginal incentive. I mean, Doug uses this number, small businesses create 80% of the jobs. They also lose 80% of the jobs. I mean, the net, you know, there's a lot of research on this. The net business, net job creation, when you take account of what they lose, it's pretty much the same from all segments.
Large, but you ultimately need private sector job creation, don't you? I mean,
of course, but that's not what we're talking about, because we had higher tax rates. We had plenty of private sector job creation in the last decade, in the 90s, I should say, two decades ago. So the idea that somehow private businesses won't create jobs if we restore the Clinton tax rates, come on, Doug and I were both old enough to remember that. That's just not true.
Let's go to Wethersfield, Connecticut, and Steve. Steve, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm a small business owner, and I see it as being, you know, two-part. A, we need to cut our spending, but we also need to increase taxes. We need both. I mean, as when I find that my income is not matching my expenses, or if I have to start borrowing to run my business, then I have to look at other means of revenue. And in the recession, what I've found is that the middle class, who in the past made up a lot of my client base, haven't been there, and as a result, the wealthy have taken up more of that role. And you know, it's a flexibility thing. When times are good, the middle class can take more of the burden. But now, as we need more revenue, those sources just aren't there. And it's very similar to running a business. It's cash flow.
But if taxes go up on folks with 250 plus household incomes, and Douglas Holtz-Eakin makes the argument that would be a lot of small business, and maybe like yourself, is that going to cut back on their hiring, Steve? Is that going to cut back on their part in the spending that drives the engine of the economy?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, just from how I see it running my own business, you have to always be flexible in how you're getting the revenue, and you know, that's always changing. So you know, in times like this, the middle class, they don't have it, but there are people who do, and so you know, it's not just a matter of cutting spending, which we have to do, but we also have to increase revenue. So
yeah, it's kind of a housekeeping, a straightforward housekeeping issue. Douglas Holtz-Eakin, how about that small businessman's argument? If it were his business, he needed to put some more in to balance the books, he'd do it. So let's do it, he says.
I agree with that. I think that if you look over the long term, as much as I dislike the out-of-control spending, there's a real chance that we're going to have to raise more than the traditional 18% of our national income in taxes. So the issue will become, how do we raise it? And tax reform has always consisted of low rates and a broad base. Those are the kinds of reforms that are most beneficial to the economy and which we'll need to raise marginal tax rates and preserve narrowness in the tax base goes the wrong direction from tax reform. So the steps that the administration is proposing right now go the wrong direction.
When you say narrowness, you're saying too much raise from the top of the income pyramid.
And for every individual, exemptions for special factors, whether it's a housing interest deduction, which rewards people for being over-leveraged, whether it's a corporate interest deduction, which rewards corporations for being over-leveraged, whether it's special credits for tuition. These are all things that were in there for laudable goals, but which at a point when you need growth get in the way. So,
but you're saying don't raise it on the affluent, raise it on everybody.
It will not be an issue of how we – of whether we'll raise taxes on the affluent. We will. The question is how, and I would like to do it in the least economically damaged fashion, least economically damaging fashion possible. I certainly don't think we're prepared to do that tax reform this year, so that's why I'd like to see the good pieces of the Bush tax cuts extended, and then let's go to tax reform. I'm all for that.
Dean, what do you think is actually going to happen here? I mean, do you think that President Obama and the Democrats in Congress, who are not unanimous on this, do you think they're going to, in this midterm election year, they're going to have the what it takes to step up and say, let's raise these taxes? Are they going to put this off until after the election, or, you know, extend the Bush tax cuts for another year and see what's up then? What are you anticipating, Dean?
Well, a lot's up for grabs. Now, keep in mind, if they do nothing, so the taxes go back, revert to the pre-Bush levels. So, you know, again, people will spin this whichever way.
It won't be described as nothing, though. It'll be described as, you know, letting taxes...
Well, again, I don't know. I mean, obviously, the Republicans, the people who support the tax cuts will say they raise taxes. The Democrats or people, you know, who don't support that will say they just did nothing. But, you know, as a practical matter, the law says, you know, at the end of this year, the taxes go back to the prior level. So if they do nothing, they haven't raised taxes, they've just let the law lapse. But as a practical matter...
You know that's not how it will be described, but I mean...
Well, again, that'll be described different ways by different people, again, you know, but my guess is that they certainly are going to try to get President Obama's proposal through before the election, which that way they would be able to run on saying that they cut taxes for, you know, for 95% of the population, but there's no guarantees in that, you know, so I think they'll try to do that, whether they're able to do that or not, I don't know. They may end up doing something like just passing a one-year extension of the whole thing.
Richard in East Lansing, Michigan. Richard, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I'd like to point out that the numbers that people talk about don't mean much to the average taxpayer. Billions and trillions of dollars, we don't know what we're getting for that.
If we
would talk about this in terms of what these taxes would provide, if the tax cut were allowed to lapse. Harper's Magazine back in 2005 published a figure that the value of the Bush tax cuts was equal to the cost of total infrastructure repair in this country. Think what a shot in the arm to the economy that would be when you talk about creating jobs.
So don't just do it in terms of numbers. Think about, I don't know, a smart energy grid and bridges and roads repaired and infrastructure up to snuff. Douglas Holtz-Aiken, how about it? Maybe we would have been better off.
Or think about it in terms of jobs, which is 900,000 additional jobs if we keep the tax cuts where they are instead of raising taxes on the higher income.
But Richard's looking at most of the last decade and saying if we hadn't gone down this road, we might have been better off with the infrastructure it could have paid for.
You know, I think Dean and Richard are wonderful economic historians, but we are in 2010, and we face a decision. And we do it at a time when this economy desperately needs to create jobs. I think the ultimate metric should be how much can we grow and create jobs. There is no substitute for that. And so when I look at the research I've done, 900,000 jobs from doing this versus less than half of that from the extension the administration is proposing, a lower unemployment rate, additional household saving that allows people to fix their mortgage and credit card problems and still an economy that grows faster, that's the right recipe. People like to demagogue the Bush tax cuts, fine, that's history. I'm worried about Americans right now and Americans going forward, and we need to have this economy grow.
Somerville, Massachusetts. Owen, you're on the air, Owen.
Hi, Tom. Great show. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a teacher and in a public school, and a couple of years ago, our principal was talking about having to lay off 10 to 15 teachers. He ended up laying off one, and in the district, they were talking about laying off 50 teachers district-wide, and they laid off, I think, 10 or fewer. So, and I asked him about this, and he said it was primarily because of the stimulus money they got from the state, that the state got from the federal government. I've driven around, I see these signs of these roadworks that say American, sponsored by the American Investment and Recovery Act. And I know people who bought cars with a cash for clunkers, so I don't agree with the idea that the stimulus money has not created any growth. It may not have created the growth we wanted, but the way I look at it, a job saved is as good as a job created. That's one fewer person on unemployment and one more person out there spending money.
So you're glad for what's been spent, but I mean, you know, going forward, we've got to have growth to support that kind of spending, don't we, Owen?
Yeah, well, the other thing is, if the tax cuts for the big business, like, for example, your station yesterday reported that Halliburton recorded $500 million in their quarterly profits, and these tax cuts have been in place for 8 years. What did Halliburton or any other big company, did they create new jobs? Did that lead to growth? I don't understand the argument that the tax cuts, I still see unemployment at 9%, so where are these tax cuts doing that?
In the meantime, happy to have your job. Owen, thanks for calling. One more, Donovan in Ames, Iowa. Donovan, you're on the air.
Yeah, I would just like to comment, as a taxpayer, I wouldn't mind having my tax rate increase if I had faith that the federal government was spending those dollars in a wise and efficient manner.
Let's take that straight to Dean Baker. Dean, you know a lot of people worry about that whenever you talk about tax rates going up. Whoever's going to pay the higher rates, what do you say?
Well, obviously, we always want our money to be spent as good as possible. And, you know, I'd say the record's mixed. Sometimes you have some very effective spending. We have lots of things we could point to with our tax dollars. For example, we have a lot of public universities that are the models for the world. The rest of the world would love to have universities like University of Berkeley in California or Michigan. You know, people come from all over the world to attend that. We could point to lots of examples. The Internet, you know, we could point to any number of cases where tax dollars have been very well used. And then, you know, we have John McCain running around talking about the $1 million Woodstock Museum, which let's say was a waste. I don't even know, but let's, you know.
Yep.
So it's always going to be a mixed bag. There's not any, you know, sort of pure answer that's always going to be good, always going to be bad, where you find waste, you want to get rid of it. But, you know, frankly, if we spent all our time and all we uncovered was a $1 million Woodstock Museum, which is about, you know, 1/1000th of 1% of federal spending, I'd say we've wasted our time. You know, as a practical matter, we should put the stimulus in context. The net stimulus from the public sector, because we had cutbacks at the state and local level, was around $150 billion a year for 2009-2010. We were trying to offset a fall in private sector demand of $1.2 trillion. $1.2 trillion in lost demand from the private sector versus $150 billion in stimulus coming from the public sector. Well, it wasn't enough. It's sort of like if our house was on fire, we got 5 or 6 buckets of water, threw it on the fire, and we go, it's still burning. Water doesn't work. You need a lot more. And that was, this was, none of this is 2020 hindsight, by the way. I and others, Paul Krugman most prominently, we were saying this back, you know, in January, February, and the stimulus was being proposed. It wasn't going to be enough.
More, not less. Douglas Holtz-Aiken, we just got half a minute. What do you think is going to happen here? Do you think that those top rates will jump back up at December 31st?
I don't think so. I think there will be a vote in the Senate, which is a vote Democrats will take for political purposes. Their counterparts in the House know this is a bad idea. They don't want that vote. That'll leave us in a position of having done nothing in December. Everyone knows that the worst outcome is to raise taxes on everybody this year, so they'll kick it down the road 1 year.
We'll watch and see, but there's the argument for and against on the tax front. That story clearly not finished. I hope we can have you two back to look at it as we move on down this really important road. Douglas Holtz-Aiken at the American Action Forum in Washington, thanks for being with us again today. Thanks very much for joining us. And Dean Baker at the Center for Economic and Policy Research. Dean, in Washington, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on.
Listeners, thanks for being here. Thanks for your thoughts. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.